Today is Tuesday, March 14th, the year 2000. We're in East Lansing, Michigan, and I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Lois Lund for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the university, which will be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, Professor Lund, we're tape recording today, and you give us permission to tape?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. I'd like to start first with you said you had an introductory statement where you'd like to give some background, and then we'll have, if you would be pleased to do that, and then I'll have some questions for you.
Okay.
So I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. One of the things that I thought I'd share with you is that I was an administrator for 20 years in three locations in the U.S. And prior to being an administrator, I was a teacher and at the collegiate level for 12 years, and following stepping down from the role of dean, I became again an instructor or a professor for 11 years. So I've had a kind of a balanced administrative and teaching role over these 40 years. The thing that I wanted to share with you is what this field that I've been involved in is all about. Because of the stereotypic view of home economics, human ecology. And so I thought it would help you and listeners to have some idea of how this thing started, and then how it changed and why it changed in the way it did. Because it enters into what we were able to do here at MSU. The concept of home economics was initiated in the mid-1800s and really took real value during the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution really changed the United States industrially in factories and in business and so forth, but it did not change positively homes and families within homes. There was great fallout that really was deleterious to households. Human ecology, home economics, domestic science, whatever you want to call it, is the application of science to the management of the home and its near environments. So it includes such fields as human development, including child development, human welfare, including study of health and well-being, and food safety and nutrition and prevention of disease. It included financial well-being, the study of financial well-being. It included the study of housing, of interpersonal relations within the close environments of the family. So initially, this field, which started in the 1850s and really took shape finally around 1910, was chiefly a woman's field. There were a few men, illustrious men, who entered the field, particularly in the area of science and related to nutrition. But initially, there was a very strong stress on the application of science to problems of families and household. There also was stress on simplification. This was the end of the Victorian era, and in which every home was filled with goods and hangings and drapes and you name it, and it involved not only a tremendous amount of labor, but also involved the hiring of mostly immigrant labor in order to manage the home. And when that immigrant labor went into industry, rather than working in households, there was a loss of that kind of help, and immediately the person who was the homemaker was responsible for managing everything within the home. That meant that you either simplified or you made the household work an incredible job. So this field that dealt with home and family began to evolve as a scientific field aimed at the management of the household and the management of people and the management of things around in the period of time between 1900 and 1910. And the field eventually organized as a collection of applied sciences, both physical and social, with the focus on family and home and the near environment, that is, the near community. And the titles that the field was given was domestic science, domestic economy, home economics, and eventually today, change into human ecology. This movement from home economics to human ecology produced some wondrous historic stereotyping. And let me explain what I'm talking about, not only related to a woman's field, but also a field that dealt only with home and family and never ventured beyond the household door. MSU was founded in 1855, and it was founded as an agricultural college of the state of Michigan. The very first class that came in was in 1861. It was an all-male class and was preparing some jobs in agribusiness, as we call it now, but primarily farming, farming as an industry. In 1862, Justin Morrill sponsored the Land Grant Institution Act. And at that point, money came in from land grants to certain kinds of education. And it states in that land grant that it is to promote the liberal and practical education of the industrial classes in the several pursuits and professions of life. And predominant among that was the profession of homemaking and motherhood. The first class to come into MSU was in 1870 of women, and there were 10 co-eds that came in at that time. Those women really studied the agricultural program. They did not study, they had few classes that were related to women's efforts, but primarily it was an agricultural program. In 1888, a program was funded by USDA called the Agricultural Experiment Station Program. It was further funded by Agricultural Research Service, but many of research funding programs were evolved through USDA, some of which were located in the states, and AES stations were located here at MSU. Funding was given there by the feds, matched by the state, and faculty in those units were university faculty and fitted into the promotion and merit increase and the whole thing. But research was identified for agriculture and agriculture-related areas. Home economics was identified as a related area. Another program that was established was through the Smith-Lever Act, and the Smith-Lever Act established the Cooperative Extension Program. And the Cooperative Extension Program was also a USDA-administered program, but it established cooperative extension services in each state in the Union and primarily in each county in each state. And specialists and extension agents in both agriculture and home economics were established throughout the state through that system. Another public act was the Smith-Hughes Act, which was around 1918, and it established vocational education in both agriculture and in home economics. This meant that high schools were mandated to teach agriculture classes and to teach home economics classes. The first home economics curriculum was established here at MSU in 1896. And it was called domestic economy. Now, the reason that I'm telling you all of this is that briefly, what we have historically is a field that is an applied field with focus on home and family and near environments. It's essentially science, physical and social oriented. It is female dominated, and it is agriculturally dominated and controlled. Not by the people within, not by faculty or by leadership, but by public policy. Because legislative acts and funding were directed to the home economics, domestic economy, whatever you want to call it in those days. And those had very significant shaping characteristics on the field. Now, this domination by ag through by the acts and public policy acts of agriculture continued up until after World War II. And then, and into the early 50s, the change really occurred as a consequence primarily of increased opportunities for women and diminished funding for agriculture. These kind of ran in at two times. There also was much more sophistication in the areas within home economics than could be supported simply by agriculture. So what you began to see was home economics breaking out of the barriers that had formerly supported it. And MSU's struggle began in the 1960s, and it culminated in the decision to form the College of Human Ecology in 1970. And I tell you this because that enters into what we were able to achieve during the years when I was a dean. One of the things that I should share with you is that when I was trying to develop some notes so that I could tell you what this was all about, I began to realize that I'm very history conscious, and that all of the records that I had evolved over some years as a dean were stored in the basement of the Human Ecology building. Those records included enrollment trends, significant collections of records where we did analysis year by year, including budgetary analysis. And shortly after I stepped down from the dean, that basement storage area was sealed by the university because of asbestos contamination. And so, to my knowledge, they are still sealed. So, prior to my departure, I had placed as much of the historical data down there as was appropriate at the time, and there very little of the annual data that I evolved that should be in the archives was placed in the archives because it is contaminated. Which is an interesting kind of thing. It may be that sometimes history becomes contaminated, but not by asbestos. I did not go through and pursue getting those records. I didn't go through the channels to do that, but at some time someone might want to do that. Mm-hmm. My recollections here are based on what records I took home that were my personal records and included two drawers of speeches and reports and items of that sort, which I went through to draw out the kinds of things that were done year by year. Mm-hmm. And I think, on the whole, that what I'm going to share with you is almost as accurate as would be true of the actual data. But they may be a little slanted. Let's see. You asked about my general education and professional background. And I was born on August 9th of 1927, a very auspicious year, since that was the year of the hare. And the year of the hare is an auspicious year. I was reared in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, which at the time I was there was population of about 7,000. My father was a businessman. My mother was a science teacher in high school. She taught chemistry, and after her marriage became a homemaker and mother. They believed in two things: success through education and responsibility to community. I have two siblings, an older brother who is 3 years older than I. He has degrees from Harvard and from Harvard Business, and has been both in business and education. He's 75, but he currently is continuing work at Boston U. We don't give up. I have a younger sister who is 5 years younger than I, who has, her degrees are from Minnesota, University of Minnesota, and she has worked in education and in business, and her degrees were in economics. I graduated from high school in 45 as the valedictorian of my class, and graduated in 49 with a BS with high honors in food research. One of the things that happens in families is if you admire your parents, you sometimes follow your parents. And we all admired my mother, and so we all dipped into science avidly. In 1954, I received a Master of Science with a major in food research and a minor in higher education. The thesis work I did was on ascorbic acid and dehydroascorbic acid. Then PhD in 66, again a major in food research, but with a minor in agricultural economics and a collateral field of higher education. What I found was that I was teaching and reading at the desk materials in food science, but that when I came home, I was reading economic journals. And I began to realize that I was a combination of the interests that had been in my family, of both business and education, and with very significant interest in business, and particularly financial management. The dissertation that I wrote was on an eclectic approach to study of children's consumer behavior relative to food. And a colleague of mine, Marguerite Burke, worked with me in developing a technical bulletin on that, which came out in 69. The research was supported by the Food and Consumer Economics Research Division of ARS in USDA. I have some observations. I was reading in the Yankee magazine, this month's Yankee magazine, and there is an article here about Barry Moser, who is a very significant illustrator and publisher of precious books. And he is talking about his background, and he said, "We are, all of us, shaped by experience." Moser is a man keenly aware of his formative influences, and he views bygone factors, elements, personalities, influences, and epiphanies, what he calls vectors, as crucial in understanding not only himself but his art. And I think that's true of most of us, that we are an accretion of experiences, and we are not really independent. We are what we become.
Did you have a, in the course of your graduate study, when you were working on your dissertation, how was it that you came to choose that area? Was it another teacher, or was it just an area that you saw the need for, or was it suggested to you? How did you come to choose that?
Dissertation?
Yes.
I was interested in consumer behavior, and the field of economics for many, many years, consumption behavior was kind of a stepchild, because production behavior was the key thing for most of the years. And even now, there's relatively few people who are interested in consumer behavior, with the exception of predicting what people will take off the market.
Mm-hmm.
But
like in advertising,
yes,
or
yes,
that type of
yes.
thing.
And I was really interested in that. I also was interested in an eclectic approach that is methodology, studying not just direct vectors to an action, but a multitude of characteristics that children exhibit that makes them move in a certain direction. And so when I said an eclectic approach, this studied the child and family, it studied the child within the school, it studied the child within the market, it studied the child within nutrition knowledge, many different areas of concern, which I then used a factor analysis, which is a new technique at that time, and to separate out, to see if we could get a picture of the kinds of variables that were determining certain kinds of behavior. And that was interesting to me, which was a methodological study. Up until the mid-60s, if you wish to do an analysis with many, many, many variables, factor analysis was so complicated and so time-consuming that until the computer services were available, became readily available to researchers, there was no way to undertake this. I've forgotten how long they said it would take if I had to do it by hand, but I mean, I wouldn't live that long. And so the time when I brought, this was in the day of cards,
mm-hmm.
You brought your cards in and you gave it to the machine, and the machine cranked and cranked and cranked and cranked and cranked and cranked, and eventually you got some kind of response from it. Nowadays, that would take seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the researchers today have enormous benefit gleaned from this kind of services that have been evolved. The funny things did happen, though. One day I brought in a box of cards and gave them to the computer people, and I waited and waited and waited. Finally, after I went back the next day, they gave me the box back, and they said, well, and I looked inside, and the machine had taken a nice big bite out of all of my cards, and in the cavity it said, delicious.
Delicious.
Wonderful. In those days, you never, ever had one set of cards.
Uh-huh.
You always had a backup. Or
and you did
three.
In this case?
Oh, yes, definitely. I knew enough not to trust anybody. But that was fascinating. Really was interesting to do. And the methodology used became one that was able to be used by other researchers, not only in consumer behavior, but in studying nutrition. And so that was interesting to me, that it was picked up and used.
Would you say again, what year you finished your degree?
And I finished it in 66.
66, okay. Mm-hmm. And what was the university?
University of Minnesota.
Minnesota.
All
okay.
of these were Minnesota.
Okay.
Why one university? Okay, because I get asked this question every so often. One university for two degrees, like Bachelor of Science and Master of Science, is sort of usual. That's not a problem. But many people have asked me why I stayed on to take a PhD at the University of Minnesota. I stayed on because there was almost no opportunity for a woman to study economics anyplace else who came with a background in food research. And it was only because I knew, had worked with several of these people, knew them, and could talk with them, and could explain where I was coming from and what I wanted to do, that I was allowed to even try out for a place in the PhD program at AggieCon. I was told that I would need to re-register and retake the AggieCon courses so that I could prove that I could compete with the undergraduate students. And so I did. I wasn't going to argue. I wanted my goal. And about one-third of the way through, the students in the class went to talk with the professor and said, "Do you know you put this woman who gets creams off all the A's, and it's not fair to us? I mean, that's not fair." And so fortunately, the protest of the students helped me get into the program.
That's interesting.
And who am I to knock that?
Small revolt.
Yeah. A small revolt by the right people. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting time. Mm-hmm. I was born during the Depression. And in fact, my father lost all of his savings because his bank failed. I mean, the bank he had his money failed just before I was born. And I grew up in the Depression years. I was a young woman during World War II. The role of women at that time was extremely interesting because from 1927, when I was born, until the late 30s, women's role was as homemaker and mother, period. But when the war broke out, there was no one to run the machines. There was no one to do this, there was no one to do that, there was no one to handle the traffic in the streets. And so women were then put into career, women were able to work in jobs that paid money. And the minute the war was over, there was enormous pressure placed on moving women back to homemaker and mother. The biggest propaganda I've ever read came out from that time. Very, very interesting to go back and read. You were supposed to go into the kitchen and into the nursery, and by George, you were going to get there. Well, those of us who had lost our future partners had no one to go back to in homemaking and nursery, and so decided to go on for further education. But out of this anger by women, came some of the feminist movement. Also came the civil rights movement and attention paid to disabled people, to disadvantaged people, to minorities, to children, to elderly. All of this began to surface at the same time because of real discontent among 50% of our population. And it's still true. Then there also were tremendous career opportunities that began surfacing after World War II. So at my time, when I was doing professional study and the early career years, there were very few women my age who were studying for a PhD. They were all having babies. I don't denigrate that. That's just the way it was. But after, so that you could count on your, probably on one hand, the number of women my age who got a PhD, as I did, and who were interested in any administrative role or even any paid occupation. Mm-hmm. So for many years, I served as the single female administrator in many institutions, and that was especially true in the 60s and 70s. And you asked about the positions that I held. I was an instructor for several years, but administratively, I held the title of assistant director at the School of Home Economics at the University of Minnesota. Once I had completed my PhD, I was instantly asked if I would serve as assistant director, and agreed to do so. Then I had a phone call from Roy Cotman at Ohio State and wanted to know if I would come over and interview for a position of dean of associate dean in their College of Agriculture and Home Economics. Do you notice agriculture and home economics that tie? No. And I said that I didn't really think that I wanted to. And Roy says, what do you mean you don't want to? The least you could do is come over here and look at us. And so I got kind of cajoled into it, and so I did, and was there for a period of time. And then when I was there, we had a series of meetings of students who would come and meet with our students at OSU. Ohio State was one of the 10 largest home ec programs in the U.S. It had over 1,000 undergraduate students and about 180 graduate students.